The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From the Book of Serenity, Case 100, Langya's Mountains and Rivers. The pointer. One word can cause a nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. This drug can kill people and can bring people to life, too. The benevolent, seeing this, call it benevolence. The wise, seeing this, call it wisdom. But tell me, where does the benefit or harm lie? A student once asked Master Langya, purity is originally so. How then does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? Langya said, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? Hongzhu's verse. Seeing existence without considering it existent, turning the hand over and back. The person on Mount Langya does not fall behind Gautama. Here we are. I've been thinking a lot about Dada Roshi over the last month or so. I think with Ongo and Chuzo Hosen and then into December with the vigil, he's been coming to visit me. I've been going to visit him. We've been having conversations. And so I thought about this mountains and rivers, which was so important to him and to his teachings, to us. It became such an important part of our training here. Dogen's teaching on mountains and rivers, drawing on his own really lifelong experience of being in the mountains, and these mountains in particular, in the Adirondacks. Also, I think because we've been compiling a collection of stories from folks who were here in the very early years, just stories that they remember about what it was like to be here. Shoban, one of our students who's a writer, is helping to do this, interviewing people, and we're putting it together into just a simple collection. It's not going to be published, but we'll make it available downstairs. I just want people to, when they come here, to be able to look back a little bit through these other folks' experiences into what was happening here in the very early years, in the very early months. Themes of cold will show up again and again. Potatoes and carrots, main diet. Cars that were well used, and some of you probably would not even get in now because they were death traps. Doing a lot with a little. As Dada Roshi used to say, we're just going to do this like it's happening. And so these mountains and rivers. In the pointer, when he asks, where does benefit or harm lie? That's really not an innocuous question. We could put that on the pillar at the front gate. As you enter here, consider, where does the benefit or harm lie? If all conditioned things are existent, or suffering, where does that suffering lie? Where does the alleviation of that suffering lie? That question can kill us. It does. But it can also give life. It does. It brings immeasurable harm, but it also brings unimaginable benefit. When we ask it correctly, when we understand it correctly, to ask that question is a sign of taking responsibility. Where does the benefit or harm lie? All the things that we experience, the good and the bad, the easy and the difficult, fear and hesitation, self-doubt, patience, love, generosity, those are words, good words, important words, but just words. What they point to don't exist in the words. It said, when you say the word fire, your mouth does not burn. We know somehow that we are a part of it, but perhaps not well enough. If all things are originally pure, pure here means undefiled, untainted, complete, empty, uncorruptible, immeasurable, boundless, which is another way of saying that they don't dwell anywhere, they don't abide anywhere. When Chuan yesterday invoked the Prajnaparamita Sutra, where the Buddha talks about not standing in, not abiding in, not making a dwelling place in. Buddhist practice, if we practice it well, in a sense, that's our ascetic practice. And you can do that ascetic practice eating three meals a day and getting enough sleep. But to not abide, we could think of as an ascetic practice. It's difficult. And so this student asks this important question. If purity is originally so, if all things abide within their own dharma state as empty, free, unhindered, unbound, unconditioned, not abiding anywhere, then how from this do mountains and rivers and the great earth appear? And Langya, who's in the Rinzai, Linji lineage, 10th, 11th century, said, answered the student, purity is originally so. How then does it produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? What is he saying? In the Surangama Sutra, which is one of the sutras in the Mahayana tradition, it's not so well known. In the West, we've never taken it up as a Dharma study. It would be good to do that at some point. It's a large text. But in that sutra, Ananda asks the Buddha, if the aggregates, the skandhas, the faculties, your senses, and all the various perceived objects that you can experience with your senses and consciousness are all the matrix of the thus come one, or basically all in the realm of suchness of the Buddha, unhindered, free, and all of this is fundamentally pure, is realized by the Buddha as fundamentally pure, then how is it that suddenly there come into being mountains, rivers, and the great earth? And why are all these subject to a succession of changes, ending and then beginning again? In other words, if they arise out of this purity, out of this unconditioned state, in which there is no beginning and end, there is no change, because there is no quality, no characteristic, no thing, no thingness, then how do these things arise that do change? What is the relationship, to speak of it that way, poorly, between what we call the relative and the absolute? Why does the Heart Sutra make such an emphatic point of this? Why do we chant the identity of relative and absolute? Why did Dongshan teach the five ranks? These teachings that are difficult. They are difficult to understand because they're speaking about the deepest things and things that we can understand with our mind and our intellect, but we can't know intimately. That's why we're sitting in a zendo, not a classroom. So how are we to understand this? And how to understand this, not as some sort of abstract philosophical question. On a path of liberation, what are we not liberated from or within? ourselves, each other, and things. The mountains and rivers and the great earth, which just basically represent everything that comes into being. If we possess Buddha nature, if that's our nature, and it's not really an if, right? The Buddha verified that and has been verified generation after generation. Having Buddha nature, that being our nature, which is pure, undefiled, unconditioned, then, and that's in essence peaceful. And its very nature is peaceful because there is nothing within it to be in conflict. Then how do we explain, how do we understand all of the conflict that from that basis arises? And so the Buddha responds and says, you've asked me about this. I'm paraphrasing. He says, haven't you heard the Buddha speak of the wondrous understanding which is intrinsic to our inherent enlightenment, to our fundamental, wondrous, luminous understanding? Basically, haven't you heard me speak about Buddha nature? That inherently, fundamentally, that is our basic nature, right? It was here before you came. It will be here after you leave. It is in each and every person, whether we practice or not. Even a hell being is endowed with Buddha nature. And so he's asking this question. And the Ananda says, yes, I have often heard the Buddha speak of this. And the Buddha said, well, when we talk about this, this understanding of Buddha nature, which characterizes enlightenment, do we mean an understanding that is intrinsic to our inherent enlightened nature? Or does this inherent enlightenment lack understanding until we gain it when enlightenment is realized? In other words, is this inherent nature that we possess, Buddha nature, complete in full from the beginning? Or does it become complete and full when we realize it? In a sense, does something need to be added or changed? Does something need to happen? And then the Buddha goes on to say that if you say that it's something that needs to be added, that's just problematic because it means then there isn't actually fundamental Buddha nature because it's insufficient, it's inadequate, it's incomplete. And so it can't be something that's added. And so he goes on to say, so the turmoil that comes from not understanding this gives rise to mental strain. And as the mental strain is prolonged, we grasp at objects of the mind. And this mental strain and grasping at objects together create a turbidity of mind out of which the afflictions are generated. The mind becomes turbid, right? Think of a river, right? In a heavy rain, where everything over the mountain is flowing in and it's muddy, it's opaque, you can't see through it. It's swirling, it's carrying things down with it. It creates whirlpools, it takes things down and spits them back up. It's not clear. And the implications of this are profound. We live them, we practice them. We hear the teaching that we have Buddha nature. We don't quite believe it. We have some measure of faith, perhaps. We don't really believe it because we fight ourselves. We fight what arises in our mind. We don't like much of what arises in our mind. We want to put it somewhere, away. We try to remove what is bad. We want to get the good from somewhere and bring it in and add that. But where is this good going to come from? Where is the bad going to go? And this good and bad, can you actually hold it? When we have a desire for something and we obtain that something and we have the feeling, the experience of pleasure, right? That feeling of pleasure, the good, is not in the object, right? It's not a thing, therefore we can't hold on to it. We can hold on to the object, but the feeling of pleasure wanes. What is that showing us? It's showing us the evidence. It's an experiment that we've done 100 million times, right? And we still don't like the results, so we keep doing it again. And what that's showing us is that the pleasure that we are derived initially is not in the thing. Because if it was, it would never wane. We would always have, it would always give us the same amount of pleasure. And something, even if we find the thing that we've been looking for, we have to protect it, keep it. When it wanes, we have to go looking for something new. We can lose it. We will lose it. And so this, the Buddha is saying, is can never be true enlightenment. Because for it to be true liberation, it cannot be dependent on something, because being dependent on anything, that anything is impermanent. And when it goes, what we're calling enlightenment, peace, fulfillment, it goes too. And so we need to practice in accord with our Buddha nature before we have experienced it, before we really perhaps even understand it, or perhaps even have faith in it. And to the degree that we practice in accord with it, the path will unfold nicely. That doesn't mean it will always unfold nicely in the way that we think it should. Nice here doesn't mean according to my view of nice, but it will unfold in the way that it, as Dharma, can and should. But the basic practices that we receive and begin practicing at the very beginning, before we understand, before we see, before we realize, before we necessarily even have much faith, are clear enough, if we are sincere and conscientious, that they will guide us in practicing in accord with our Buddha nature enough, sufficiently, so that we continue and things begin to unfold. And of course, there will be lots of moments where we sort of turn away from that. We're not actually practicing in accord with the instructions. So the instructions everybody receives at the beginning, when something arises, don't judge it. Okay? How many of us have not done that? Right? Because we were faithful to what we were taught. We've all done that over and over and over again. And when we do judge, right, there's consequence. It hurts. It's painful. That's showing us something. If that response, the judgment, wasn't accord with the Dharma, it wouldn't create more pain. And so we might think of practices, the Buddha talked about being too loose, being too taut, that in essence we're practicing, trying to stay on the path, actually practicing in accord with the Dharma, practice, which means really practicing in accord with our true nature, with our purity, with who we really are. And then we wander, we waver. And when we waver, if we're paying attention, we will notice, because there will be signs, too tight, too excited, too agitated, or too loose, dull, sleepy, complacent. And then we respond. And we bring it back more into alignment with the teachings, which really, again, means our nature. And in that way, sort of moving back and forth, we're discovering what the Buddha called one aspect of the middle way. avoiding those sort of extreme ways of responding. Dogen said, these mountains and rivers of the present are the actualization of the word of the ancient Buddhas. Each, abiding in its own Dharma state, fulfills its virtues completely. Because they exist in the state prior to the kalpa of emptiness, they live in the present. Because they are fundamentally pure, they are here. Because they are the self before the germination of any subtle sign, they are liberated in their actualization. As they become actual, they become actual in a liberated state, not in a confined state. And these mountains and rivers of the present are you and me and everything. But then, of course, the question is, well, if that's true, then why aren't we living liberated lives from the beginning? So in Buddhism, an infant is born into this world not as a blank slate, because this life is one in an ongoing stream of countless lives in which karmic actions are carried within the consciousness that now appear in this sweet, adorable little baby, right? Who is sweet and adorable and not a blank slate, carrying the seeds of these past lives. And so they arrive with, we might call it a personality, or dispositions, or certain inclinations. This sweet, adorable little baby is different than this sweet, adorable little baby, born from the same mother, same bloodstream. Because the virtues of the mountains are high and broad, the power to ride the clouds is always penetrated from within the mountains, and the ability to follow the wind is inevitably liberated from the mountains. We can't practice apart from the self. We can't liberate ourselves apart from the self. When Dogen says to study the way is to study the self, he means the whole Megillah. Not just the part of that self you want, like the enlightened part. There is no part. The power to ride the clouds is penetrated from the mountains itself. The study and liberation of the self is always entered from the self. That's why we sit and turn inward to that very self and enter that mountain form, this mountain form. This mountain body, heart, breath, energy, mind. And we see that within Buddha nature, which we all possess, we see mountains and rivers and the great earth appearing in every form, sensations, emotions, memories, the whole catastrophe. And we see our response, our reaction, our habitual response. And that is most important, because the mountains and rivers that are rising are fine in and of themselves. This thought, this emotion, this sensation, it doesn't have a will, it doesn't have a consciousness, it doesn't have a plan. Its purpose is not to trouble you. But our karma, the way we have learned and have responded 100,000 million times, is what happens in this moment when we don't examine. And so, in a sense, what's more important, you might say, than the object that arises is what I think it is, which is the basis of what I do with it. I love it. I hate it. I blame you for it. I blame myself for it. I want more or less of it. And we sit to observe and hold. Not in a tight fist, but in an open hand. Hold. Right there. Steady. Steady now. You want to run. I know. You want to... Right? The words are on your tip of your tongue. Right? And you just hold. And sometimes it takes a little bit of effort to do that. And sometimes, oftentimes, we don't. We just spill. But then we notice. And we hold again. In another chapter in the same Shirangama Sutra, Purna asks basically the same question and says, now that the Buddha has realized this wondrous emptiness and understanding, will the mountains, rivers, and everything other conditioned phenomena, as well as the habits and outflows of beings, ever arise for him again? So the Buddha has realized that all things are empty, that all things are in a state of perfect peace. Will they still arise? And the Buddha said, consider the analogy of someone who loses their way in a village and becomes confused about which way is north and which way is south. Have they mistaken their direction because of confusion or because of understanding? In other words, are they just confused or do they have an understanding that is not helpful? Purna says, they're lost neither because of confusion or understanding. Confusion has no basis in reality. It's not a thing. So how can it be a cause of their being lost? Confusion is not doing something to the lost person. As for understanding, how could that be a cause of being lost if they were to actually understand? And the Buddha said, the same is true of the Buddha, of an enlightened one throughout the 10 directions. Confusion has no basis in reality. It's just a state of mind. It's a perspective. We may think that we have lost, right, our perspective, but actually we've just gained a different one that we call confusion. In its very nature, it is ultimately empty. There never was anything real about the confusion, self-existing. It only seems that there has been confusion and understanding. Once one has awakened from one's confusion, the confusion disappears, and from that awakening, no confusion will arise again. Or if it does arise, it will not arise in the same way. Being lost. Can you relate to this? Have you ever experienced being actively living your life full of purpose, things to do, accomplishing, getting things done? From all outer appearances, things are fine, and yet somehow feeling lost, unable to find our way, being unclear about our whereabouts, about where we're going, about what's important, about how to go wherever we're going. It's a very disconcerting feeling, which I think perhaps is why everyone who experiences that loss, if they're alive, so often cannot tolerate it. Cannot tolerate it. And so we lay something on top, a map, a plan. And so part of practice is learning how to tolerate that discomfort, that tension. There is a discomfort that is, you could say it's inherent within the path because it already exists within us. I've often said nobody comes into Buddhist practice because they're having way too much fun in their life. Everything is going way too well, perfectly. There's a recognition on some level, that something is not something. And if you've ever been lost in the woods or on a mountain or in a city, it's disconcerting. If you've ever woken up from a deep sleep in the dark and not know where you are, it's disconcerting, right? The first thing you want to know is where am I? Locate yourself. It's almost like a primordial need. And in the mountains or in the woods or in the city, we can look around and we see things, tangible markers, trees, rivers, landscapes, buildings, bridges. But we, when we're lost, we don't know how to read those things. We don't know how to use them as markers. We don't know whether they're pointing in the path that we need to go. There seems to be a kind of confusion. We don't know what they're telling us. Or we can just blaze ahead and misinterpret what one person called bending the map. We can just decide, no, this means go this way. Not because it does, but just because we need to know. And when we don't know where we're standing, how can we know which direction to take? It's very difficult. Which I think is part of the wonder, the miracle, the beauty of being able, being willing to acknowledge on some level, I'm lost. And it's uncomfortable. And to encounter something that I don't know, the Dharma, teachings I've never heard, practices I've never experienced, and to have a sense that this is true, that's a lot of something. Where does that come from? I was talking to somebody recently, on Christmas Day actually, who lives locally and likes to hike, and we were talking about different trails, and there was a certain trail that we both liked to hike a lot. And she said she was hiking one day, went out, a beautiful day, hiked up to the top of the mountain, enjoyed the view for a while, then was coming down, and it got dark. So she's in the dark. And she got lost. And so she just plopped herself down and was preparing to spend the night there. She had a cell phone. The battery was dying. So in the last minute, she pressed some button, which is sort of like a GPS, an SOS something. And somebody actually called her, like 9/11 or something. I don't know actually much about this. I want to check it out, though. Seems like a good thing to know about. And she said, I'm in the mountains on this trail, and I'm lost, dead. And so she just settled down. And then after a while, she heard someone calling. And it was a ranger who had gotten the coordinates and come to help her. So she realized she was lost, and she stopped. And she sat. And she was prepared to wait, to be patient, right, until daylight. Jimon and I were on that same trail once during the day, and we were coming down, and the trail went through a very, very wet, marshy spot that we sort of slogged our way through on the way up. And we thought, why don't we cut into the woods, go around this? So we did, and lost the path, right? So we were looking for it and couldn't find it. But we just kept walking in the direction in which we knew the path was. We couldn't see it. We weren't really clear whether it was near or far, but we knew it has to be in this direction. And eventually we came across it. Kept moving in the direction of the path. So there are different ways of responding when we're lost. Buddha seemed to know in his own path. He was able to read the signs on a path that he had not yet walked, right? Because that's the way it works. When you're walking the path, every step for you is new, is uncharted. Even if hundreds and thousands of people have walked it before you and have even led you, left breadcrumbs, teachings, for the student, every step is new. It's like a wilderness. And that, too, we have to tolerate. That's why faith is so important. But faith alone is not enough. We have to be alert and aware and examining. And then I think as time goes on, we're able to look back on those times of confusion when it might have felt like we were walking in circles or going down a dead end or just getting caught up in something that was completely unhelpful. And we look back and realize, no, not completely unhelpful, not completely lost, not an absolute dead end. But from within that moment, when we're still in that uncharted territory, we can't know that. And that's why faith is important, to trust and to stay close to the path, right? And if you're going to wander away from the path, know that you're doing that. And if we wander away without knowing, well, that happens too. So be observant along the way so that you can recognize what are those markers that will bring you back. Dogen says, those who doubt that the mountains walk are liberated, do not yet understand their own walking. It's not that they don't walk, but that they don't yet understand, have not yet made clear their own walking. Being originally pure, as mountains and rivers arise, it seemed to obstruct us. We may not yet understand what these mountains and rivers are, how to actually put them to good use, that they are not actually obstructing us, but they are the path itself, that anger is how we develop patience, that doubt is how we cultivate faith, that distraction is how we develop and strengthen our mindfulness and concentration, that discomfort is how we strengthen our tolerance and our resilience. It's all there, but we don't yet understand it. We don't understand that we're walking. We're doing it. When somebody comes in, as has happened lots, and says, I don't know if I can do this. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You're doing it. What is it that you think you're not doing? It's the idea of what I should be doing, of what doing it right should be bringing forth. In other words, I'm just creating mountains and rivers that I want to give me comfort, maybe to assuage the doubt, the tension. That's why the teachings say, there has to be adversity in practice, which is really not a big order, right? It's not a big ask, right? Just show up. It'll come. We bring it with us. And then, you know, Rahatsu, we add a little. So that we can learn how, not learn so much learn how to walk, but realize we're walking. The Lankavatara says, all beings have disregarded their own selves by clinging to external objects. Thus, they are turned around by things. If they can turn the object around, then they will be like the Buddha. Beautiful. So when you're sitting and something arises that begins to turn you around, you turn it around. Stop. Sit. Look. Persevere, be patient. Don't reject, don't grasp. Turn it around. Be like the Buddha. The teachings say that when the Buddha realized enlightenment and said, I and all beings in the great earth at this moment all attain the way, that that was true. And at that very moment, there were people all over the world who were in pain. and confused. In the mind of the Buddha, not only had he attained the way, but everybody had attained the way, being naturally pure. And then he spent the rest of his life raising mountains and rivers and meeting mountains and rivers to show us that the world is abundant in its own way. Each thing is abundant in its own way, which can be a difficult thing to trust when the world is so troubled. And so where does the fault, where does the harm, where does the benefit lie? That question comes back. Find out. As we enter into this night, we'll be sitting later, and then tomorrow into midnight. It's normal, not unusual, to experience worlds coming by. Very ordinary, often. Achiness, tiredness, boredom, doubt. Turn them around. It is not happening to you. This session is not happening to you. We are not doing something to you. You are not doing something to me. To actually take responsibility is liberating. It means you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait for the right time or the right conditions, because guess what? It's here. It actually doesn't get a lot better than this. And so, having received so much from those who have come before us, this is a way we can give back and then offer it forward. So let's really appreciate that we have this time. We are in the midst of this. So many people, there are a bunch of people, I met with some bunch of them last night, who are with us in one continuous thread. And they spoke about how incredibly important it was to them to be able to do that from home and be here with us and to see us sitting. So just right there, you just being here, minding your own business, taking care of this, is helping somebody you don't even know about. But I just told you. But that's happening all the time, all the time. We don't really know the effect of our action, and in a way we don't need to much of the time, but to know that what you're doing is good, is true, that's important to know. And then do what you do with a gift. You give it, and then it goes where it goes.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.